ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
After 200 years, white Australian law has finally acknowledged that Aborigines once owned this continent. Residents of the Murray Islands and the Torres Strait owned customary title for their land.
Only the representatives of the mining industry were left sitting as the Senate erupted.
Mabo establishes a fundamental truth and lays the basis for justice.
Hello, Kirsty Melville here with you for The History Listen and the final episode in our series, Section 71, High Court Cases That Changed Australia. Law professor and barrister Patrick Kayser picks up from our last episode with the story of the long and intensely bitter fight over the Hindmarsh Island Bridge in South Australia. And just a warning that this story contains the voices of Aboriginal people who've passed away.
If we got down to secrets, I could see them being never-ending.
This was really, in many ways, the beginning of the cultural wars.
You know, once again, whitefella law sucks when it comes to embracing Aboriginal issues. They don't know how to do it.
Just because it isn't written down by white men, that doesn't mean to say that it's not true.
In December 1995, South Australian Ngurundjeri elder Dr. Doreen Katinyiri made her second heritage application to then-Minister for Aboriginal Affairs, Robert Tickner. She argued the site was culturally significant to Ngurundjeri women for reasons that were secret to them.
But I say to you, all of the people of Australia, that I am very conscious of the enormous responsibility that has been placed upon me and upon my colleagues by the verdict of the Australian people today.
John Howard became Prime Minister of Australia in March 1996.
And it was a landslide last night. About one-third of Paul Keating's ministry was caught up in the huge anti-Labor swing across the country. Some of the ministers touted as future Labor leaders are now out of the parliament.
Among those ministers was the Keating government's Aboriginal Affairs Minister, Robert Tickner, who'd been crucial in supporting Doreen Katinyiri's heritage claim.
Hindmarsh Island, of course, was a really tough time of my life, but that pales into insignificance to the Aboriginal women who suffered so greatly from the disparagement.
Under the Keating government, Robert Tickner had introduced reforms that entrenched Indigenous rights into law, including native title legislation.
Howard came to government promising buckets of extinguishment of native title rights.
Journalist Margaret Simons.
And attempts to really accommodate the legislation that the Keating government had passed with the very strong lobby groups of pastoralists and miners, among others, who were basically spreading panic about the implications of the Mabo decision.
The mining industry in particular and the pastoral outback industry, they didn't know where they sat.
Former Defence Minister and one-time President of the National Farmers Federation, Ian McLaughlin. He'd been a powerful critic of the Ngurundjeri women's heritage claims.
We didn't think that pastoralism and mining could go on in the way it should go on unless there were some decisions made about some of those things.
The Howard government was still required by law to assess Doreen Katinyiri's heritage application. So it came up with a new law that would get rid of the heritage claim once and for all. In December 1996, the Howard government introduced the Hindmarsh Island Bridge Bill into Parliament.
The Heritage Protection Act does not authorise the making of a declaration in relation to the preservation or protection of an area or object from any of the following activities. A. The construction of a bridge and associated works, including approaches to the bridge, in the Hindmarsh Island Bridge area.
So what this did was cut out one area, and one area only, from the Aboriginal Affairs Minister's responsibilities, the Hindmarsh Island Bridge area, the very same spot that Wendy and Tom Chapman's company planned to build the Hindmarsh Island Bridge.
Labor says its change of heart eliminates the need for yet another inquiry. Leader Kim Beazley wouldn't appear on camera today, but says the Hindmarsh Island Bridge is now the government's problem.
This then blocked, forever, any further Indigenous heritage applications on the Hindmarsh Island Bridge site.
I was extremely disappointed. I don't think it was a high point for the Australian Labor Party, let alone for the government of the day. That was when Pauline Hanson had just been elected and John Howard was still dancing on my political grave, as he was entitled to do. And then, of course, this piece of legislation had the effect of, again, essentially overriding the Aboriginal interests that, acting on good faith, I'd seen it my responsibility to protect.
We were there having a meeting in Canberra discussing the Native Title WIC decision. As I remember, down the corridor, they were doing the High Marsh Island Bridge bill.
Ngurundjeri woman Sandra Saunders.
One of the pollies who was responsible at that time, he's arguing that, you know, we should do this and we should do that. And I just, I was furious and I jumped up from the table and said, you know, you expect this and down the road you're destroying Aboriginal culture by that bill. It was shocking.
I mean, there are whole movements to further more claims in the Aboriginal group, and I couldn't see where they were ever going to end. Be something else next. And it had to stop. Got to get on and run the country.
The High Marsh Island Bridge Act stopped all future heritage claims being made over the site. And by 1997, Dr. Doreen Katinuri was dealing with serious health problems. She'd been diagnosed with stomach cancer, the illness that led to her death 10 years later in 2007. So in the same year of her diagnosis, Doreen Katinuri turned to the last resort in the fight over the High Marsh Island Bridge, the High Court of Australia.
She was concerned to win, to be heard, and there were now many other actors, political actors involved on both sides. The stakes were very high.
Aboriginal opponents of the proposed Hindmarsh Island Bridge in South Australia have won their fight to take Canberra to the High Court. In a case with implications for the Howard government's planned WIC legislation, they say the federal parliament has acted unconstitutionally.
In September 1997, Doreen Katinuri and her legal team began challenging the Hindmarsh Island Bridge Act in the High Court.
Earlier on, we struggled to think of where we could go, and then we decided to take the challenge.
That's lawyer Sydney Tilmouth, who recently retired as a judge of the District Court of South Australia. He was part of Doreen Katinuri's legal team in the High Court case. As an Indigenous man with a lengthy career in the law, how does he view this tension between the protection of Aboriginal heritage and development?
It's a question of balance. What about Mary McKillop's example, her school down in Penola in the southeast? I expect nobody would dream of touching that for development purposes. You only have to think a little about some analogies of quite sacred places in our culture to see that it does matter.
What did you think was more broadly at stake in the High Court case?
Well, more broadly was really, in my opinion, an attack on the whole Native Title Act that had been passed by the previous Labor government.
Stephen Kenny, who was Doreen Katinuri's solicitor in the High Court case.
And the belief that Aboriginal people could protect sites of significance to them. And that's what I felt was at stake.
In the first half of the 1990s, the High Court delivered a number of groundbreaking judgments, including the recognition of native title in Mabo and its extension in WIC. But the Howard government was highly critical of what they viewed as an increasingly activist High Court. They wanted to appoint judges who would only declare the law, not make new law. Deputy Prime Minister at the time, the late Tim Fisher, had famously said that Cabinet intended to appoint, quote, capital C conservatives, unquote, to the High Court bench. In February 1998, when Doreen Katinuri's High Court case began, the Howard government had just appointed Justice Ian Cowan, a man known for his conservative views. And in the days leading up to the hearing in the High Court, Stephen Kenny received some surprising information about Justice Cowan.
I had a letter that had been faxed to me anonymously from Justice Cowan when he was a barrister, saying that he had provided some advice to the Commonwealth
And that wasn't just any old legal advice. The facts revealed that Justice Cowanan had advised the Howard government about the legality of the Hindmarsh Island Bridge Act, the very law that Doreen Catinieri was about to challenge in the High Court.
We went to Justice Cowanan before the hearing and asked that he stand down because we said to him that he had provided an opinion to the government about this particular act and therefore he had a conflict of interest. And he told us in court, he said to us, I provided an opinion to the Senate as a public citizen and was entitled to do that.
But then, in the first few days of the hearing, everything changed.
The newest High Court judge, Ian Callanan, has withdrawn from the Hindmarsh Island Bridge case after initially refusing a plea
yesterday,
to do so.
Which showed the judge had provided the 1996 legal advice to the Aboriginal Affairs Minister and not to a Senate committee, as the judge had earlier recollected.
I subsequently received a letter which said, and I'll just quote it, correspondence which Justice Callanan had overlooked and matters in respect of which his honour's recollection was not accurate have been drawn to his attention. Accordingly, he intends to withdraw from any further participation in this matter.
Stephen Kenny never found out who sent him that anonymous tip-off. But more than 25 years on, a framed copy of that letter is still hanging in his office.
Well, it's not every day you get a High Court judge writing to you saying that, you know, that he forgot things and he got things wrong. You know, I often think of people in court and I myself have on many occasions, you know, simply forgotten a material fact. So it's good to see that High Court judges are also fallible.
This is Section 71, a series about the High Court constitutional battles that have changed the course of Australia's history. I'm Patrick Kayser. In May 1998, the case continued before the six remaining High Court judges. Doreen Catinieri argued that the Commonwealth had no power to pass the Hindmarsh Island Bridge Act. You see, in order to pass that act, the Howard government had relied on a section of the Australian Constitution called the Race Power. It gives the federal parliament the power to make special laws for the people of any race.
When the Constitution was adopted in 1900, there was no doubt that it was a racist power.
James Spiegelman was Chief Justice of New South Wales, and in 1997, he was the barrister leading Doreen Catinieri's legal team.
It was a power to do anything the Commonwealth Parliament wanted to do with respect to the members of a race. It was mainly at that stage directed at Chinese, but not only.
Originally, the Commonwealth's race power excluded Aboriginal people. The power to make laws over Indigenous Australians was held by the states.
It's important that we should have the maximum vote because the eyes of the world are on Australia.
But in 1967, Australians voted in a referendum to allow the federal parliament to pass laws related to Aboriginal people. For James Spiegelman, the 1967 referendum didn't just change the wording of the race power, it changed its meaning.
My argument before the High Court was that that was done in order to benefit members of the Indigenous Australians, and that had changed the nature of that power fundamentally, that even though it was originally a racist power, it was now a power to enact legislation for the benefit of Indigenous Australians.
So Doreen Catinieri's legal team argued that after the 1967 referendum, the federal parliament only had power to make special laws for Aboriginal people that were beneficial to them. That's why they said the High Court should strike down the Hindmarsh Island Bridge Act as invalid, because it was detrimental to Aboriginal people.
You've got to construe the words in context. And one feature in the context was definitely the constitutional referendum of 1967.
Justice Michael Kirby was one of the High Court judges who heard Doreen Catinieri's case. He was sympathetic to the argument about the impact of the 1967 referendum.
That had the biggest vote that has ever been given in a constitutional referendum. Australia turned a corner and wanted to do the right thing by the Aboriginals. And here was a case just 20 years later where the decision was being made to do them really down and to use the power, the new power, to reduce their protections under the law. And I thought that was not what was intended by the power, as understood against the background of its history.
The power is there. It could be exercised, as it always has, for a racist person, but by reference to contemporary standards, one would expect a parliament not do it.
The Howard government's argument was made by Gavin Griffith QC, who was then the Commonwealth Solicitor General.
So the underlying issue of parliamentary power, it's a matter of leave it to the confidence of the parliament not to act discriminatory laws, not to say that there's a constitutional limitation.
The Solicitor General argued that the government had the legislative power to make the High Marsh Island Bridge Act, even though some might see it as being detrimental to Aboriginal Australians.
In the unusual circumstances of the Hyde Marsh Bridge case, one might say there was a balancing of interest, the interests of persons and Aboriginal race that were being propounded, against a view of to whether or not the Hyde Marsh Bridge should be built for reasons of the wider interests of the people of Australia, particularly South Australia. Now, my own view, that's not a question answered by the Constitution. It's answered by the parliamentary process. And in this case, Parliament did express a view. It said balancing those interests with respect to this limited area of the pylons for Hindmarsh Bridge, then the wider interests beyond those of persons of an Aboriginal race should prevail.
You said you weren't surprised when the decision came down the way it did.
Well, none of the questions and body language of the court seemed particularly sympathetic, and it was a pushing the envelope kind of submission.
Former High Court Chief Justice Robert French says it would have been hard for the judges to accept Doreen Kitinyre's argument.
The question then becomes, how do you judge what is a benefit? Because one person's idea of a benefit may be another person's idea of a detriment.
If they agreed that the race power limited Parliament to make only beneficial laws for Indigenous Australians, this would have made it difficult for the court in the future.
Take, for example, a law that restricted alcohol availability, in particular Indigenous communities. Now, there are some who would say that's beneficial. There are others who would say it's discriminatory and takes a paternalistic approach.
But courts have to draw lines in the sand all the time, and characterising a law as positive on the whole or negative on the whole is something courts do and I think should do with the racist power. And the plain fact of the matter is that over the history of the Australian nation back to settlement, we have not by our legislation adequately protected the Aboriginal people of Australia. And therefore, we have a warning, and that warning should make us careful about the interpretation of our constitution.
Hind Marsh Island has proved a bridge too far for Aboriginal rights. The High Court case involved Narrangeri women seeking to stop the Hind Marsh Island Bridge in South Australia. The High Court today ruled 5-1 against them.
We lost it, I think, because the court was concerned about setting a precedent. But the court would have been well aware that the impact of that would be that if the government wanted to replace one program that benefited Aboriginal people with another one, the precedent would have been too difficult for the parliament in the future.
I think in Doreen's heart, she always knew Whitefella law wasn't going to protect Aboriginal people. And when it comes to embracing Aboriginal issues, they don't know how to do it.
By 1998, the media frenzy around a small corner of South Australia and secret women's business had pretty much died down. The spotlight had moved to laws introduced in the wake of the High Court's Wick case, the Howard government's so-called 10-point plan, which was designed to limit native title rights. So when Doreen Kitinyre lost her case, it was seen as the canary in the coal mine for those who wanted to challenge the 10-point plan using a similar argument about the race power.
A future High Court challenge to the government's Wick bill could still be possible after a decision today in the High Court. Dana Robertson reports the court has left open the question of whether laws can be passed which are racially discriminatory.
A future test case could have a different outcome because there'd be two new faces on the High Court bench and also because native title has been recognised in the common law.
But no legal challenge was ever made to the 10-point plan.
It never occurred because of the ruling in Kitinyre. So in that sense, it was quite a significant matter.
And John Howard's former Defence Minister, Ian McLaughlin, says the case also may have been a warning to other Indigenous people claiming heritage protection based on secret women's business.
I think it's sorted out that if you're not absolutely sure about your claims, you've got to be a bit careful, or otherwise you might run into a bit of a headwind.
It's been a long and expensive road to today's opening of the Hindmarsh Island Bridge. More than a decade of legal wrangling was put to rest as the first few cars crossed the bridge joining Goolwa and Hindmarsh Island.
In March 2001, the Hindmarsh Island Bridge was opened to the public. But that was not the end of this sorry tale.
Our aim is to get our possessions back, our development back, our compensation, the bridge built, and get on with our lives.
In 2001, developers Wendy and Tom Chapman said their marina on Hindmarsh Island had become less valuable due to Robert Tickner's July 1994 ban on the construction of the bridge. At the time they made this claim, the Chapman's company Binalong was in liquidation. So they sued Robert Tickner, anthropologist Dr. Dean Fergie, who supported claims of secret women's business, and Professor Cheryl Saunders, who recommended the ban. The Chapmans claimed $20 million in compensation, arguing that Tickner, Fergie and Saunders had engaged in false and misleading conduct. This meant that in 2001, the Hindmarsh Island Bridge affair had to be considered afresh by South Australian Federal Court Judge, Justice John Von Dusser. Robert Tickner.
Personally, I was cross-examined for 6 days in that court case on everything that had transpired in the entire history of that case, including my own media releases.
There was an agreement that no other men would be in that room and that Doreen would give evidence with her lawyer, who was a woman. She decided against much heartache to do it.
Ngurundjeri woman Sandra Saunders.
Because she said, this is the last time I'm going to have the opportunity to actually put the case about the importance of a Kumarat to women. She was very ill at the time and she was a mental and physical wreck.
Justice Von Dusser had to decide whether Robert Tickner, Dean Fergie and Cheryl Saunders had acted appropriately in supporting Doreen Katinuri's claim. Justice John Von Dusser delivered his decision on the 22nd of August 2001.
Justice Von Dusser said he was not satisfied the women's knowledge was fabricated or was not part of genuine Aboriginal tradition.
The evidence received by the court on this topic is significantly different to that which was before the Royal Commission.
Today's judgment in Adelaide also dismissed a $20 million compensation claim by the developers of the Hindmarsh Island Marina for delays over the bridge's construction.
I remember just going, go Von Dusser, like in the court, and people were just enjoying me and Doreen were going, yes, yes. Doreen was very, very overwhelmed with that decision because it vindicated her, and so it was worth it for her.
He really understood what was going on and he got it right. He got the facts right. And, you know, it's like, thank God for that. Someone's finally listened to us and believed us. And, you know, we knew we were right all along, and now someone in authority has agreed with us. So after about 5 years to get to that stage, it was certainly fantastic.
Essentially, that decision of Justice Von Dusser rejected all the allegations of misfeasance and improper behaviour against me. My integrity emerged from that case unsullied and I think indeed respected by the court.
In the almost 2 decades since the Hindmarsh Island Bridge affair, a lot has changed for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, not least around questions of culture, heritage and land rights. Associate Professor Margaret Simons.
The mining industry hasn't collapsed, far from it. It's been through boom times. The pastoral industry is in trouble, but not for reasons that have anything to do with native title. So I think a lot of the air of panic that accompanied a different understanding of our history has subsided, and perhaps there's a more recognition that reconciliation demands other things of us.
And for South Australian judge Sidney Tilmouth, the courts today deal much better with native title claims and confidential evidence than they did during the long struggle over the Hindmarsh Island Bridge.
The federal court, under the guise of judges who understood native title, worked out some really good protocols for giving evidence of this kind in groups, in private, imposing conditions about circulation and so on.
Could the competing claims over the bridge site have been handled differently from the outset?
Absolutely. I mean, I work with Aboriginal people and mining companies and petroleum companies, and sometimes the petroleum companies want to go somewhere that is a site of significance. Pretty much on all of those cases, we've been able to come to an accommodation between the mining or petroleum company and the group's spiritual beliefs about a particular place. And that would have been possible if it hadn't been such a politically charged time.
In September 2002, a year after the Von Dusa decision, bones of an Aboriginal woman and child were found on Hindmarsh Island. The same year, the local council issued a sorry motion for their ill treatment of Ngurundjeri people, which many read as an apology for the long-running and ugly Hindmarsh Island bridge affair.
I think you should remember the strength of Aboriginal culture, the strength of Aboriginal women to stand up for a belief, and a group of women and men in this country stood up, regardless of what was thrown at them. And there was everything thrown at them.
I will go on fighting with every strength of my being to prove that I did not fabricate these stories, and I will do it for my people.
And that was the voice of the late Dr. Doreen Cutnieri. Ending our final episode in the series, Section 71, High Court Cases Which Changed Australia. It was produced by Jane Lee. The sound engineer was Melissa May, and our executive producer is Michelle Rayner. And remember, you can catch up on the whole series on the ABC Listener app. I'm Kirsty Melville, and I'll catch you next time for another deep dive into our past on the History Listen. See you then.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.